Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm here in Wall Street, New York City, and joined by David Calloway, CEO of American financial news and services site, The Street. David previously spent 4 years as editor-in-chief at USA Today, where he's credited with growing the online newsroom to the fifth largest in the US. Prior to that, he ran MarketWatch, where he's responsible for its expansion from 20 to 120 journalists worldwide. He's won two Society of American Business Editor and Writers Awards and been named as one of the most influential people in business journalism. Dave, thank you for joining me.
That's great to be here, Paul.
Did you always want to be a journalist?
Absolutely. From as far back as I remember. I grew up here in New York, and my father was in the advertising business. He did media advertising. So I get to hang out with a bunch of journalists, the sports columnists and stuff like that. And so I always kind of idealized the lifestyle. Of course, journalism was far different back in the 70s, but I liked it. And then I found in high school I had a penchant for writing, and so used that to apply to various colleges, went to Northwestern to the Medill School of Journalism.
What came next then after that?
Well, I survived college and managed to get a few clips in the meantime, did some internships at some newspapers. I did a summer job at the New York Daily News here as a copy boy. They don't have copy boys anymore, but
what's a copy
you probably
boy?
Don't remember.
But
before there was the internet, if a reporter at his or her desk wanted to see a story about, say, the president that they had written 6 months ago, a copy boy would run back to the library, which was called the morgue in those days, find the story, a yellowing piece of paper, from 6 months ago, and run it back to the reporter. So it was a glorified gopher position.
But a foot in the
door. Not so much as getting, didn't really have to get coffee, but had to do pretty much everything else. But it was a foot in the door, a chance to get a few writing clips. And for me, it was very exciting because I got my first taste of how romantic journalism could be when I was working at the Daily News. The first year I was doing mornings, it was kind of a bit sleepy, especially since the journalists didn't come to work until 11 a.m. But in the second and third year, I worked nights. So I worked 4 to midnight. And one day they asked me to accompany a photographer out to the baseball stadium, the Yankee Stadium here in New York. And I got to go with the photographer, and we walked down the steps and sat right on the field next to the dugout, and best seats I've ever had to a baseball game. I got to watch the game for 7 innings, just sitting there with my feet up. Suddenly he pulled the film from his camera and said, right, get it back to the newsroom by deadline. No internet descended over, right?
Oh,
so
no,
was to race the film back at it's 65 miles an hour on the freeway outside here in New York, the FDR Drive, in a souped-up ex-police car that the news photographers had. Having the time of my life. Got the film back in time for deadline, and it was the next morning's paper.
It ends well.
So the next day, they sent me to another game, and I found myself spending the whole summer at the baseball stadium. I said, I can get used to this journalism type of thing. This is fantastic. So I was hooked.
So you obviously knew at that point then that journalism was for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I like the romanticism of it. I like to be able to travel, do interesting things, and write about it.
Did you always want to become, how ambitious were you? Did you always envisage yourself as editor of USA Today running something as huge as The Street? Or did you always want to be, presumably you wanted to be more than a humble copy boy?
Yeah, I think nobody really kind of can, when you look back on a career, can really anticipate that you were going to do some of that stuff. I mean, my original goal was to be a reporter. Right. And my, far held fantasy would be a foreign correspondent. Right. And so I got a job as a reporter, and I got to do more than I ever could have hoped for in places like Chicago and Washington and Boston. And then I got a job in London in the early 90s for Bloomberg News as a foreign correspondent. So I had already realized, everything that I wanted to do. And then it was just continuing to do it and having fun. I spent 5.5 years in London, or 5 years, I guess, covered everything from the death of Princess Diana to the collapse of Barron's Bank, which was a big financial crisis in the 90s, to, beginnings of the single currency in Europe. And just had a wonderful time, traveled all over Europe. Then went back to the States to a new place for me, California, and got involved in the early internet days with CBS MarketWatch. Never thought I'd be an internet journalist. Didn't know what that was when I was in college. Wanted to work on a newspaper. So your priorities shift as you learn things in journalism. And you, I never wanted to be a business journalist. I wanted to be a sports columnist or a political columnist. You know, when I was going to university, this was 10 years after Watergate. Everyone wanted to be a political columnist. Take down a president, you know, all that fun stuff. But
I hope someone does that but, in the next couple of
years.
Yes,
exactly. They're trying. There were no jobs as a political reporter. There were jobs as a financial reporter. So you take the job. I found that I liked it. I liked the markets and how things fast things moved, the fact that there was money involved. It was very much like covering sports, right? There's big personalities. There's a lot at stake. There's winners. There's losers. And you can measure it like you can measure somebody's goal percentage or wins and losses or batting average here in America. The markets are great measuring devices. So and then when I moved to London, you know, I realized that it was a global game with currencies and international markets and stuff. So I was hooked from the very beginning on financial journalism, brought that and combined it with internet journalism at CBS MarketWatch, and I made for a thrilling ride.
And warm weather, too, in California. That, I imagine that was quite a contrast to rainy London.
Yeah, it was. You know, California actually, in Northern California and San Francisco, it's actually quite cold and foggy. In fact, the fog I thought I would encounter in London is in San Francisco.
Oh, yes.
You know, in London, it was more just rain and, you know, occasional smog. But, you know, when it's nice in California, it's fantastic. And I still have a home there.
And did you get any semblance of the way that the internet would completely and fundamentally change journalism in those early years when you were at CBS?
Well, you know, we thought we knew, right? But we didn't, right? I mean, what we were actually doing back then was, you know, now be defined as the most primitive form of desktop journalism. No video, no mobile connection, no social media. You know, none of the things we take for granted today, no podcasting. You know, it was basically HTML on a web page, right? And if you were lucky, people would select your web page as one of their favorites and they would go there occasionally. There was just, you know, no connections whatsoever. And I think even in those days, we knew that a lot of businesses were going to gravitate to the internet. Amazon was still already around. You know, it was still 10 years before iTunes or anything like that. But we didn't know how socially connected everyone was going to be and the impact that would have on journalism. You know, something like TweetDeck, right, where a lot of journalists are now on. You know, nobody ever imagined anything like that back 15 years ago, 20 years ago. So, you know, whenever I talk to young college students, young journalism students today, you know, I tell them that, you know, they're going to look back at you know, our iPhones and our podcasts and our Facebook posts and our TweetDeck, kind of like we, like I look at the fax machine. When I was starting in journalism, fax machines were the hottest technology. We were going to fax each other stories.
I think we should start doing that again. Wet lead trousers as well, maybe.
So it's what's remarkable is the technology changes, the delivery mechanisms change, the business models change, but the great need for stories. You know, and you could certainly look at journalism. I look at it optimistically as that change brings opportunity. You could look at it pessimistically if you're, say, in a newspaper or, you know, and you've been through a lot of turmoil. But change is good. And one thing that hasn't changed is the public's demand and desire for news. In fact, the public demands and desires more news than ever today than it did years ago. You know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago when I broke in, it was enough to just read your paper each morning on the way to work. Right. You were informed. You know what was going to go on. Maybe watch a little telly at the end of the day to see what happened that day. A little radio in your car on the way home. But now we're all on our phones all day long, accessing news, sharing news. It's a much, much more interconnected market. And news is even more important than it was then. And what journalists do, even more important, though you may see some argue against that.
Do you think the news business has it harder now than ever? It seems to be under attack from a number of fronts. One is the commerciality, the commercial reality of it. I mean, you've taken us around the streets newsroom. There's 200 people here. It's vibrant. It's buzzing. But in many other newspapers, finding actual journalists in newsroom are few and far between. There seems to be less money in journalism. And then, of course, there's the attack on so-called fake news. The new president, Donald Trump, is attacking lots of different media outlets, effectively de facto banning outlets like CNN, the BBC, outlets that he doesn't approve of. It seems to me that in many ways journalism faces a stronger challenge than ever.
Yeah, it's, I mean, discuss. Journalism to discuss.
Yeah, yes. That's a bit of a long question, exactly. Wasn't it?
journalism has always been challenged by business models and change. I mean, even when I started in the newspapers in the late 80s, people were forecasting the end of newspapers then, and, you know, here we are 30 years later. You know, some of the great news organizations now weren't around then. CNN wasn't around when I started. Bloomberg News wasn't around when I started. You know, forget Huffington Post, Slate, all the others. You know, only the kind of long-held papers like the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Boston Globe were around and are still around today. So the commercial challenges remain. The political challenges have always been there also, just not so much in our country here in the U.S. I'm very active on a couple international journalism boards, and reporters who are active today in places like Turkey or China or Venezuela know all too well what a hardcore leader can do to free journalism and a journalistic society. And so that's why what's happening with President Trump is so frightening to most journalists, right? It could be viewed in some quarters as entertainment, and, you know, finally he's taking them on and blah, blah, you know. But there's a worry behind it for those of us who kind of see what's happened in other societies. The free press around the world has shrunk dramatically in the last 10 years. 74 journalists were killed last year, almost 1,000 in the last 10 years just for doing their jobs. So thankfully, we don't have that here. We have a lot of bluster and the news media on the front line, but that's okay, and we can deal with that, and it's another challenge just as we've been dealing with the commercial challenges.
Last question on President Trump, though. He does seem to be trying to poison the well of journalism itself rather than taking on his critics in terms of their arguments. He actually just it plays the man, not the ball, as it were. You know, I'm thinking of the different imagery, the different photography of how many people turned out at his inauguration. He doesn't even discuss that. He just says, you guys are, it's fake news.
Right, right. I mean, of course that's not true. And, you know, there is plenty of fake news out there. And certainly every journalistic outlet has its, you know, hidden biases, which manage to find their way into print. You know, the New York Times, no different, Wall Street Journal, Market Watch, USA Today. Go over to London and, you know, this the Times, the Telegraph is viewed as conservative, Guardian's viewed as left-wing, you know. And so you can, if you look hard, you can see some of those biases emerge in the editorial. I think the journalists, by and large, try very hard to keep it as straight as possible if they can, and certainly to look for the truth. You know, there is that, you know, journalism, as you guys know, is not a high-paying craft or career. It is rewarding in adventure and excitement instead. But there is kind of a high-mindedness about people who get into the industry that they're doing something for the public good. And Trump is directly attacking that. And so, you know, it is a classic bullying tactic where, you know, you push off attention from yourself to the villain, right? And if the villain can't be Hillary Clinton because the election's over, and it can't be Ted Cruz because the primaries are over, it's got to be somebody. And so the easy opponent is the media, because the media is not a specific person. It is, you know, a collective thing, and it's very easy for the public to get its head around that the media is wrong. Well, does he mean you guys on Media Masters or me at the street or the New York Times? Just to say the media is dishonest is, you know, on its face, also dishonest. You know, I think it's very dangerous to go down that route. They used to have this saying in America back in the newspaper days when newspapers were king, you know, that, you know, never argue with a man who buys his ink by the barrel. And, you know, that is titans, Wall Street titans and stuff who fight. You know, the media generally lose. The media has longer lasting power for the most part. And I think ultimately, as things develop in the Trump administration, he will settle down a bit. But also he will find other opponents on Capitol Hill, for instance, internationally, for instance, as some of our enemies start to begin to test us. We're seeing that with North Korea already, and perhaps Russia. You know, the European Union is going to be a real test. So I think, you know, the media is a convenient scapegoat for Trump now. He's trying to put his cabinet together. They're, you know, he's being held up. So, but things will get far more serious a lot quicker. And I think direct his attention away from the media.
Dave, what's your take on how President Trump's doing with his tax-cutting economic plan? How's it playing? We're here in Wall Street at the moment. Stocks are at record highs. But is there a crash coming?
Well, it's interesting to say. Well, you know, the market has been rising essentially for 8 years. I mean, it bottomed out during the Great Financial Crisis in March 2009, right? We are now almost in March 2017, and it's been rising ever since, you know, with some short, small corrections. The average bull market's about 5 years, so we're way overextended already. And, you know, my sense is that the election of Trump and the realization that we're going to have, you know, a very right-wing Republican president who's going to cut taxes, help repatriate cash from overseas back into the U.S., and focus solely on jobs, has given Wall Street essentially another lifeline, which could last 2 weeks, could last, you know, 2 years. When we do start to come back, it'll probably be a pretty strong correction. Maybe it won't be a crash. But that's what markets do, right? They rise for several years and then they correct or crash. And we'll have to live with it. I mean, even in my career, I've been through three or four of them. So, you know, something is coming. But for the time being, it's this kind of weird parallel universe where, on the one hand, if you go down to Washington, it looks like things are completely out of control. And yet you come back up here to Wall Street and the markets are hitting new highs every day. People are making tons of money. Companies are doing well. Unemployment is almost, you know, we're almost at full employment in this country. It's a crazy parallel universe. You want to say, wait a minute, maybe things aren't so bad. Maybe they're really good. But then you have to remember the markets have been rising for a long time. So I think for investors right now, it pays to be pretty cautious.
Tell us about your time at USA Today. I mean, you deserve the credit for taking an iconic brand and really taking it into the stratosphere. I mean, incredibly impressed with what you've done there. And, you know, the trust that you have in the brand, the penetration that it has, the increase in readership. How did you end up there? And tell us about your time there.
Well, USA Today has been a trusted product, you know, America's largest newspaper for 30 years itself. Again, I'm older than it is. I was already working as a journalist when USA Today started. I guess I was midway through university. And when it came out back in 1983, it was a unbelievably controversial product, right? The stories were short. There was color.
The graphics, the color,
accessibility. In the newspaper. You know, everybody thought, you know, they called it Mick paper after McDonald's fast food, dumbing down. And yet, we celebrated our 30th anniversary right after I got there. And you know, if you looked at every newspaper in the world right now, they're very similar.
They're copying
right?
the business model.
You know, that type of model. People want short stories. And even more so, if you think about how you access news on your mobile phone, right, it is, you know, a couple of paragraphs here and you're in and or you're out. You may read a long story, but for the most part, you're going to read 10 short ones. You're looking at graphics, you're looking at color, you're looking at photos, you're looking at videos, all of those things that Al Newhart, the founder of USA Today, pioneered. However, by 2012, when I got there, you know, USA Today had kind of lost its way a bit. You know, it was still largely a print product in a digital world. And, you know, for a variety of reasons inherent to the politics within the parent company, Gannett, you know, had never really done more than just dip its toe in journalism, in internet journalism. You know, there was a web team, but they were in a different building, and then they were in a different corner of the newsroom. There was no video in the newsroom. And so, you know, a lot of what we did was basically adapt modern practices. And we found journalists in the newsroom and some outside who could come and help with those practices and help essentially create modern new digital news standards. And the results were fantastic. We had a great tech team that built us a beautiful website and a really cool mobile app, which really helped things take off.
I still use it to this day.
Yeah, it's my favorite news app, just in the way that it's put together. And a brilliant team of editors 24/7 who know now, you know, when a story happens, how to create a digital news feed out of it. And over the course of the years, as we grew, became a bigger digital news product, you know, less and less people contributed to the print paper. It was still and is still the nation's number one newspaper, outselling even the Wall Street Journal. And it's a great product, and you can still find it in your hotels and stuff like that, and in the train stations and airports. You know, most people are getting it on their app like you do, Paul.
But there were some particularly impressive innovations. So, for example, the Butterfly Edition, that condensed version that you did that was then placed in Gannett's local newspapers that was still had that accessible mix of graphics, that increased circulation by, like, is it 44%? It was astonishing.
Yeah, I mean, what we did was we found USA Today had been a very national paper, and people would read it when they were on the road in many ways so they could read about their hometown. We had that great page, the states page, where we printed a little blurb of news from every state in America. So if you were on a business trip in California and you were from Georgia, you could read about what's going on back in Georgia. So it was a way for people to get a little bit of home when they're on the road. But we had never really made major entry into local markets. So by taking Gannett's 100 newspapers, other newspapers, papers in Detroit and Phoenix and Indianapolis and Wisconsin and Florida, and putting a smaller version of USA Today inside those papers, we were able to introduce USA Today to those local markets and make those papers more robust in terms of international news and, you know, Washington.
Who's having more value to their readers?
Sports, right. And so in the first, you know, we had high hopes when we started doing it, but we were amazed, you know, in the first 6 months, not only did circulation increase at most of those papers, but, you know, they were able to raise prices because they were delivering more news. So it was a win for the bottom line for the company and a win for USA Today.
What does it feel like to sit in the editor's chair and feel that responsibility for an iconic national brand? You know, because you've took some very bold decisions in that chair, but there might have been the wrong decisions. How do you sleep at night when you have a job that's, you know, that critical?
Well, I think you just have to, you know, kind of, obviously it feels great, right? And you're really honored and you know, want to make sure it works, and you try very hard every day. And you're really, you know, mostly I'm just proud of the team that was there. They did such an awesome job. You know, specific people who just rose to the occasion. And so mostly it was an immense feeling of pride. You know, like everyone, you make mistakes, right? And we made some doozies and, you know, corrections and stuff like that. There was one time Facebook was debuting some new emojis that it was going to use for like. You know, instead of the thumbs up, it was going to debut like sad face, happy face, because a lot of Facebook users complain, you know, when your friend says his mom died, do you hit like? You know, they need more to do that, right? So they introduced these range of emojis. So I said, you know, people use these emojis on their emails, and they use them put them on stories online. We should put them on the print newspaper the next day. So we printed, you know, four stories on the front page, and one was a happy story, and one was a sad story, and it was pretty obvious what they were. And some people loved it, but a lot of the hardcore journalism folks hated it, right?
Because they thought we were down with the kids.
We were editorializing by putting a happy face on a happy news. So even the BBC called me from London to say, "What were you doing?" You know, so those are harmless mistakes, right? We never really, you know, did anything like hand out the wrong award at the Oscars or something like that.
That would never happen.
But, you know, you have to work very hard every day to make sure you get the right stuff, particularly on the editorial page, where we strove to, you know, to be right down the middle. We would, if we had a column from our editor, editorial page editor that was, you know, favoring Obama, we would invite someone to write one against him, and we would print them side by side. And so you needed to be very careful. You cover things like the Israeli-Palestinian crisis, right? And you try to be fair, and then you get blasted from both sides. But that's part of the challenge of the job.
Isn't that a good thing, though? If you're blasted equally by both sides, you feel that you've got it
absolutely
on the line.
Absolutely. That's what you're hoping for. So I had a thrilling time while I was there, 4 years. It was fun to have some influence over sports and politics. Fun to be in Washington, D.C. When
great
Obama
time.
Was in power. You know, it was great stuff, and I miss it sometimes. However, you know, your career evolves, and this is a great opportunity I have at the street now to turn around an iconic digital company, one that was very famous 20 years ago when it started out, and MarketWatch and the street were doing desktop journalism, and, you know, both are still around in some format. And so it's a really cool opportunity. The street's got some international businesses now in the UK and in India. And so we're having fun. And I'm enjoying working down on Wall Street, which is kind of where the history of the U.S. started. Just a block from here, George Washington gave his inaugural address.
He did indeed.
He lived that. I mean, he even lived here for a while he was president, something I'm sure has not been lost on President Trump.
So, and when you wake up on a morning, do you see your challenges for the day ahead more in terms of editorial or kind of business management? How would you see yourself as an editor?
Well, it's, you know, it's really, it's a bigger job. So you have to, the challenges are in business management as well as editorial, right? In a way, editorial is my comfort zone. You know, before we started this podcast, I was in our editorial news meeting with our editor in chief and all the senior editors, and they were discussing news. And, you know, I felt at home there, right, and helping and ask questions and shape coverage. You know, but the street is more than the street.com news site. It is five different business units with five different revenue streams, and more than half of them are essentially data businesses. So data and technology is a key part of what I do right now. It's also in journalism, as you know, you know, in many ways being regarded as the hot new thing in journalism. Even at USA Today, we're struggling to build a data team that could go out there. Well, here we, at the street, we own a chunk of data, and shame on us if we don't make the most of it.
So tell us about the business generally in terms of who are the readership, what's the penetration, what's the headcount. This podcast is primarily listened to by listeners in the United Kingdom, where the Street's brand doesn't penetrate as strongly as it does here on the East Coast.
Right. If you picture the business like a funnel, right, at the very top of the funnel, the widest, largest part is thestreet.com, right? That is a free site supported by advertising, you know, for people who are interested in markets news, international markets news, economic news, latest stock movements and corporate news. 10 million unique users a month supported by advertising. It's about 15% of our revenue. It's our biggest footprint, but our smallest business.
It's the old Pareto principle, the 80-20 rule, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. Underneath that is a smaller business, but more important to the bottom line, it's our subscription business. And these are newsletters for active investors. Jim Cramer's Action Alerts Plus is the most popular one, right? That's where you get to watch him manage his portfolio and kind of be able to mimic his trades and stuff like that. And so that is a business, you know, with 65,000.
So the 10 million uniques that you get every month, they help drive customers into the funnel.
Exactly.
We had Jim Impoco on recently, the editor-in-chief of Newsweek, and he said that although they've gone back into print, he views the print version of the magazine basically as a physical banner advert for the website.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, that's how I viewed USA Today as well. It's a way to, you know, create, you know, reach, but the website is where the money is. And so the subscription business is then next, right? Underneath that, we have a business called The Daily Deal, or just The Deal. It used to be a newspaper. We bought it a few years ago, and now it's a digital product, a website, a list of alerts. It's for institutional investors, you know, who pay high five-figure licensing fees to have access to real-time deal news, you know, who's buying who the players are, and particularly its niches, kind of writing about the advisors and the lawyers that are doing the deals, right? Because those people in the mass media generally are unsung, right? They're maybe at the bottom of a story in the FT or something like that. But they're the ones that are actually doing the business and making the money. And so we find that exciting. That's what The Deal writes about. And so smaller audience, right, but higher paying. Then we get into our two data businesses. We have a data business based in Wisconsin called RateWatch. That business essentially reports on fixed income and savings accounts for banks across America who compete with each other based on, you know, the information that they have. And so, you know, that's a pure data play. We get some news out of it sometimes, but it's an incredibly sophisticated audience. These banks are paying five-figure licensing fees to be part of it. And then finally, our fastest-growing business, which is called BoardX, which is based in London. and it was founded in London 15 years ago. It was started as a corporate governance database, and they quickly found out that their users weren't using it for corporate governance. They were using it to try to find each other and meet each other. And so we've turned it into what we call a relationship management business. So if you wanted to find Jim and Poco, right? I mean, you knew you would call Business Week, right? But you could put your contacts in the database and find out, oh, you know, Dave Calloway, who I just interviewed, knows him. You know, I can ask Dave to give him a call or something like that. So that is incredibly valuable to a banker or a lawyer who's looking to do a deal. And we charge, you know, in many cases, six-figure licensing fees for that. You know, so even smaller audience, lower in the funnel, higher paying. But, you know, one deal pays for it for the whole year.
Incredible.
So it's an incredible database. And then you can use that database for news, right? You saw in the news recently that Uber out in San Francisco is having some difficulties with sexual harassment and stuff like that. Arianna Huffington, who's on the board, has pledged to help.
She's help leading an investigation.
Leading the investigation. Did anyone know that she's the only woman board member on Uber? Well, we found that out from BoardX, did a story on it, right? We can do a story on boards with women perform better than boards without women. We can do a story on whether boards with alumni from Oxford or Cambridge perform better than boards with alumni from Harvard or Yale.
Proper data journalism.
Proper data. Companies with boards of directors who are 65 years old and older do better than ones with younger folks. And so it's a wonderful way to do great journalism.
It's a rich repository of information, frankly, that's
exactly,
not being mined.
And it's ours. And, you know, you could say the business is a little bit like LinkedIn, right? But LinkedIn is a mass market business where you and I can go in and just lie on our CVs. But, you know, this business, we have it curated by a group of folks based in India, in Chennai, India. And so it's real time and it's complete and it's incredibly accurate. And we deliver it to large banks really inside their firewall. So the technology needs to be strong too.
Who do you regard as your competitors, Dave? Is it the Wall Street Journal, the FT? I know The Street says it's distinguished by its unbiased approach to its journalism, but do you think that other financial news sources do demonstrate a bias?
I think you have to look hard. You know, Trump is not completely off base. There's no such thing as, you know, I mean, the goal is to be completely unbiased, right? But it's almost like an unachievable goal. Bias is slipping in every word that is used, right? And so the practiced editorial eye can tell when they see a headline, it's a little bit of a slip, something like that. Again, you know, I don't think most newsrooms set out to do it. Biases slip in, and that's the role of editors and editors-in-chief to make sure to take them out. You know, some of the ones that do it right, you know, I think the Journal's done a good job. And you know, full disclosure, I worked – Dow Jones bought CBS MarketWatch, so I worked with colleagues at the Journal for many years. You know, Jerry Baker, I think I'm on his side in this dispute. I think he's done a good job. Even when the editorial page of his paper is rabidly pro-Trump in many ways, or at least pro-conservative, he's done a pretty good job of playing it straight. You know, the Times and the Post have chosen to be opposition in this case, have thrown their, you know, their hats in with the crowd. That's generating a lot of subscriptions for them from the left, not so much from the right. And so there's a little bit of, you know, I think I'm a little bit concerned that the, you know, in basically choosing a side, you're making a mistake. Then you might be hurting the profession long term. However, you know, journalists have often chosen sides. And in societies where, you know, where there are limits and threats to a free press, the press rises up. And so you could say that's just what the Times and the Post are doing. It's what they should be doing. So, you know, all in all, I think most people, you know, are going to continue to read the news wherever they can find it, likely on their Twitter feed. And, you know, whether it comes from the Times or the Post or the Journal or the Street or USA Today, it's really the quality of the story that's going to drive it, you know, and the interest in the story. And the fact is it fresh news? And is it something interesting and new? News is something new. So that's the key, and that's what will continue to drive us all forward every day.
Penultimate question then, because I know you have to go.
Sure.
What advice would you give to someone starting out in their career that wants to be the next Dave Calloway, that wants to, you know, be, take the editor's chair of something like this? Because in many ways, young people starting out on a career in journalism have more opportunity than ever insofar as they can make a name for themselves by podcasting and blogging and all of these kind of things. But on the other hand, the newsrooms don't have the numbers that they used to do. They can't be a copy boy for the New York Post, for example.
Right, right. You know, I think the best advice I have to the young folks is, you know, don't buttonhole yourself into something that, you know, I want to be an editor of a newspaper, or I want to work on a magazine only. You know, journalism is a rich, varied career where twists and turns are going to happen, and you'll be successful if you take the opportunities and you work hard, because the opportunities are there. You may find yourself a good podcast journalist, and you may find yourself a good video journalist, and you may find that you're better writing for a newspaper or magazine, but you should try it all. Find a mentor in the newsroom, do everything they ask you to do, and just learn. And that's where you'll develop kind of into the, you know, you'll see the opportunities will come. So keep your mind open is my biggest piece of advice to all the young ones.
What's been the best day of your career so far? What's been the day that's made you most proud? And also, what's been the worst day?
Oh, my God. That's a really great question. You know, I don't really think I could say there's any one best day or worst day. You know, probably the worst handful of days would be the days when I'd have to let journalists go, right? And we all have to do that, and it's terrible. You know, the best days are the days when my team wins a big award. You know, when USA Today wins a Loeb Award for reporting, or an investigative journalism award. You know, Market Watch won a Loeb Award, the highest American form of business journalism awards. You know, and it's always pride for the team. It wasn't so much what award I won or you know, being promoted or something like that. Best days, really, when you're with a team of journalists, they're doing well, you're proud of them.
Dave, it's been a hugely enjoyable podcast. Thank you ever so much for your time. I've learned a lot.
It's been fun, Paul. Thanks a lot. Talk to you again.
A Big Things Media production. Big Things!